Thanks. Good afternoon. This is the Design Commission, and I'd like to begin by introducing first the Bureau of Development Services staff who are here. It's Chris Caruso at this moment. The members of the commission here today are myself, Gwen Milius, the chair, David Work, the vice chair, David Keltner, Tad Savinar, Ben Kaiser, and Jane Hansen. Commission members are private citizens appointed by the mayor to provide review of new construction or remodeling of projects within designated design zones. We are not paid but serve entirely as volunteers. More detailed information regarding the purpose and function of the commission may be found in the Portland Zoning Code. Commission members must declare a conflict of interest, bias, or ex parte contact prior to the staff presentation of a case. Actually, we're hearing a design advice today. If a commission member has a conflict of interest or bias, they are not allowed to participate in commission discussion or voting on that project. If a commission member has had an ex parte contact, they must declare the substance of it on the record, and it is subject to rebuttal. We do not have an open case in front of us. We do have a design advice case today. And actually, we have an item that we've slipped in right before the design advice case, and it's a briefing on the part of TriMet. It's Alan Lido. Is that right? Yes, come on up. And Commissioner Simpson has just joined us.
Thank you very much.
If the button is up, it's on.
Now it is. How's that? Okay. I didn't bring a PowerPoint or anything. I'm mostly here to answer questions, so I do have a handout, so I'll go ahead and hand that out. You're interested in taking a look at that. The reason I'm here, is I think you are feeling some of what we're feeling, which is frustration with our ability to run service as frequent as we really ought to be doing. And that comes back to you in details like the issues around the amount of parking provided and new residential developments. We very much, of course, have a commitment to maintaining our frequent service network, which are the buses that are supposed to be running 15 minutes every 15 minutes all day, 7 days a week, the kind of frequency that people can just build their lifestyles around and not necessarily want a car even, not even have to check a schedule, just walk out and take a bus. And we are doing everything we can to maintain and slowly build back up the frequency of those buses. But they have slipped a little bit from where they used to be. And we certainly hear that and want to try to do something about that. The background, of course, is very quickly on the handout I provided, which is why we're in this situation. Yes, it's the economy. We are primarily funded by payroll tax, and when the economy goes down and unemployment goes up, we get less revenues. But we are in much better shape than most of the other systems on the West Coast that were based on sales tax that had much more significant cuts than we were forced to have. Nevertheless, that did point up some structural cost problems. If you look at the first page here of what I handed out, this is kind of what we started talking about as kind of the alligator jaws of our future revenues and cost projections. This is what it looks like if we win the Employee Relations Board review that is we're going to be hearing about this month in our negotiations with our union. This puts us a couple of years of steady state and little tiny increments of improvements, and then a yawning gap between our costs and our resources and having to cut. This is not our plan. This is what happens if things keep going the way they are. You can see, again, not our plan, but sort of the crisis if we can't fix the issues in the next couple of pages, where by FY25 we would literally be cutting more than half of the system. We don't want to go there. We don't believe we will need to, in the sense that if it got that bad, something much more serious would happen. Maybe TriMet would be reformed. Who knows? A lot of the issues are around medical benefits. We had a very long 6-year contract with our union during the time that medical benefits were shooting up. We provide medical benefits for our retirees in a way that no other public agency in the state that I know of does. And so all of those costs are loaded onto our ability to operate. We are doing our best to fix that problem, and our latest proposal does get us partway there. There's very strong and strict rules under state law around how we're able to negotiate and the timeline, which is why we're still trying to finalize the contract that was supposed to go in place in mid-2009. And we should be able to finalize that by the end of this month. That's all the background. What really matters is that we believe we will find a way through that in partnership with our union, and we'll be able to come back to growing and providing the kind of service that the city deserves and all of the jurisdictions within our district deserve. How we're going to do that, I think, is important in the sense that we've already said that what we're going to try to do is, as we were going down, we tried to preserve those frequent service lines as much as possible so that, again, as much as possible, it was 7-day-a-week service that people could really rely on. As we come back, we'll put service back there. So that's places like Division, Powell, Hawthorne, Belmont, MLK, Fessenden, all those kinds of lines that are running 15 minutes or better 7 days a week and more during the peaks when it's really needed for overloads. What we're doing is we're taking each sector of the district, five in all, and working with stakeholders to determine what's changed since the last time we looked at the system in a comprehensive way, the entire bus network. Where's the growth happened? Where is the growth coming? Where is the vision for growth? And in this case, it would be which are the corridors where BPS, the city, are really expecting for growth to occur? You know, under the vision of the comp plan, under the vision of the Portland plan, under the work of the comp plan, where is that going to be happening? We know there's a lot happening in East Portland. We know there's a lot happening on the existing main streets. So working with folks like Joe Zender and Jay Sugnet and Mark Raggett to understand where that development is going to happen and where we need to beef up our service. At the same time, trying to extend the best kind of transit service is not one that is radially based into downtown or any single point. It's a grid that allows people to go basically anywhere to anywhere, a frequent service grid. And we've got that as far as Gateway, but it falls apart a little bit farther to the east. And so as we're doing that east side, we're expecting to be able to identify where that grid needs to be strengthened. Then we'll have the vision for where we're going, and as we're able to recover our cost structure and recover our resources, we'll be able to build on that vision. That won't make it so that everybody who comes to you about parking at an apartment building is happy, but it does mean that we'll be able to stand up and say, yes, we're really increasing service, not just holding it steady. And that's our vision, to be able to support with the frequent service network, yes, the MAX, yes, the streetcar, and the rest of the network as well that serves the entire district and serves the city. We expect, you know, regional goals are saying we need to do things like triple mode share for walking, biking, and transit if we're going to do things like meet our climate goals. The city is more prepared to meet those kind of goals and perhaps even exceed them than probably any other jurisdiction in the region. And so we understand the need to really support that with service we provide and also with our partnership to try and be able to identify places where we can improve access for pedestrians and bicycles, which is why, for instance, we partnered with PBOT to seek some federal funds to do improvements to sidewalks and crossings and bus stops and bicycle on the east side in the Powell Division corridor and worked with the city and the city of Gresham on a similar one for a different set of funds. So that's kind of the story I wanted to tell a little bit. We do have that vision of being able to really restore and go well beyond. We're really talking about something like doubling the amount of service out there over the next 20 years or something to be able to get close to some of those goals. The exact vision we're going to want to develop with the city, with the neighborhoods, with the business associations, with the social service providers to understand where those things really need to go and very much informed by where the vision is for development in the long term. With that, I'm going to stop talking at you and see if you all have questions.
Questions?
Alan, how do you ever go back and look at a corridor? I mean, if you've, in other words, we're seeing a rash, or not a rash. We're seeing a blossom, if you will, of you know, infill apartments, and they're popping up in various places. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the concern, is the change is happening. You know, you've done the plan before, and now the change is happening. Do you ever go back and reassess, or is there?
Yeah, actually, this is the go back and reassess. I mean, the last time we did a really structural plan for the east side was the 80s. Now, and that's why we have this great grid. That was the transformation from an old style, you know, downtown focused radial network that was a leftover from the private business that used to run it in the 50s and 60s. In the 80s, we went way beyond what any other transit system in the country was doing and created an entire grid and put the extra service into that to make it pretty close to a frequent grid. We were missing weekends. Over time, we've built up each of those lines based on ridership that was coming along on each one of those and created the 13 frequent service lines in the last decade or so. This is the revisit. So next year and the following year, we'll be coming back and saying, okay, given what we know about growth that's happened, given what we know about the vision for growth, where do we need to grow beyond after we restore what we've got or what we should have? So yes, we do. This is our focus.
But you don't
on
do any short.
Do
you don't do short term.
We absolutely do. Basically, year to year tracking of ridership. So this year, I'm happy to say that instead of cutting service, we're doing a modest $2.1 million increase in service, and that is things like adding some early morning trips on the Powell and Division line, so that, you know, folks, especially low income service workers, can get into work and their early shifts. We're adding a little bit of frequency during the peaks on some other lines, like the MLK line and some others that are having problems with overloads. So it's those we do year-to-year adjustments, and the hope would be that we're getting to the point where that year-to-year adjustment is not a small adjustment, it's a larger ability to really respond to what changed that year.
And just a couple just structural questions I'm curious about. A starting bus driver, how much do they make a year?
An early starting bus driver starts out for the first several years doing what's called a mini run, which means they're doing a split shift. They're basically running the peak hours. And that's something on the order of $14 or $15 an hour.
So it's hourly until you're full-time?
Even full-time are getting paid hourly, so if they have shifts that go over 40 hours, they get paid overtime.
And then once you're given a route and you're a full-time employee union, what is that starting salary?
It's in the low 20s. I don't know exactly. Basically, the way...
Per hour.
Per hour, right. And that moves up. There's a scheduled increase over time. There's cost of living adjustments that happen every year. Right now, there isn't one because we're out of contract, but there are when we're under contract. Mm. The only thing that's, and the pay for our operators is a little bit higher than our peers on the West Coast, 5 to 10%, something on that order. The thing that's sort of way out of whack for us is the healthcare benefits.
Why the 5% to 10% increase above?
Say that again?
Why the 5 to 10% increase over the balance of the West Coast?
That's just where we've ended up over time in negotiations.
Are there any other large cities in the United States that aren't union for a bus service?
You know? There are, you know, the only one that comes to mind is a place called Foothills in California. Hmm. There are some, you know, every transit agency has a different agreement with their union. So they all vary.
So right now you guys are in the negotiation times and you're out of contract. Is this all being revisited?
We should be. We're waiting for that appeal. We have made a proposal to the union. The union has not made a proposal for the next phase yet. presumably they're waiting for the outcome of the appeal. So we're at least a year out of contract now, not including the fact that we're actually 4 years out of the last contract that was really in place and both sides recognized.
Because it's interesting what we're hearing, both kind of on the street and through this process, is people, like you mentioned, service industry employees are moving farther and farther out as a result of us kind of improving the city's core, mm-hmm. and by that meaning rising rental rates and ownership costs. So what we're doing is moving our workforce farther and farther out, and at the same time cutting service or diminishing service or kind of paying these costs, whether they're 5 or 10% above the rest of the coast. And it really is the foundation, in my opinion, of everything we're all working on as a city, is that backbone of TriMet service, because that's kind of what the whole city is built on, both employment-wise and circulation-wise and everything. So it is really... And when you mentioned kind of the green attempts of TriMet and kind of taking those approaches, it almost feels the best approach would be extending services farther and farther out as opposed to expending money on things.
So I agree with all of the sentiment. I'm not sure I'd agree with the solution, because we already have services that run pretty much to the edge of the UGB. So we shouldn't go any farther.
Oh, maybe not farther, so just more frequency, I guess.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, we haven't done the East Side Service Enhancement Plan. We're starting that. We're actually starting some of the contacts with stakeholders now. We'll be doing that starting basically in July and then going through about a year, maybe a little bit longer. Not to prefigure the outcome, but we certainly expect that the biggest interest, because this is what we get from our riders all the time, is greater frequency, greater reliability, mm-hmm. and a tighter grid so that people can make those trips from all kinds of places to other places. Yeah. We definitely are expecting that the basic theme of our East Side Service Enhancement Plan is to be as aware of equity issues and needs as possible, because that is one of the big dynamics that's happening. Mm-hmm. And so we'll be looking at things like, for instance, the Powell Division corridor, which Metro is going to start a transit study on. TriMet, our expectation is that would be a good place for an on-street bus rapid transit project that could be implemented relatively quickly and reduce the travel times from, you know, the far east to the center.
Thank you. I was curious how you kind of keep track of ridership on certain lines to know that within that next year you can respond to, I think what Commissioner Savinor was talking about is what we've seen in the Division Corridor in particular, mm-hmm. probably more than a half a dozen or maybe more infill apartment projects on that one street from 39th in, basically. So just how it is that you keep track and then react.
Yeah, so let me talk about this a little bit and tell me if I'm getting too far into the weeds. We have what's called an automatic passenger counter on almost every bus in the fleet. And that is, if you look next to the doors, next time you get on or off, it's the little silver box that's got three holes in it. And that's counting the number of people who are getting on and off. And we get that data basically with every single trip. Okay. Occasionally one goes out, but literally any single day we have a pretty good snapshot of every boarding, every alighting, and you know all 300,000 throughout the system. And we aggregate those together to be able to get sort of quarterly averages. But we're also able to look at individual trips and say, you know, we have regular reports to our schedulers that say, you know, during this time on line four, these three trips are overloaded. Mm-hmm. We need to adjust. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of responsiveness that we're able to do, which is a little hampered by resources right now to be able to do a lot.
Okay. Thanks.
This is kind of a sociological question. You may not be able to answer it, but I wonder if you know much about new development and kind of expectations when people move into a new building, and whether kind of once a behavior pattern is set by maybe a set of tenants, if it's possible to change them once new transit is introduced, or if the transit kind of has to be there when they get there in order to really encourage the kind of habits you want people to have.
All I can do, honestly, is speculate, and a lot of it is common sense.
Okay.
But based on you know, when we get, when we put a new service in place, whatever that is, whether it's a major capital investment like a light rail, or when we see a bus rapid transit go in place, or even when we've done a fairly significant jump to a frequent service, it takes 2 to 3 years for the ridership to kind of adjust. It kind of shoots up for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then it starts to, it doesn't level off, thank goodness. It grows slowly, but it grows slowly after that. And so there's, based on that, there's probably a grace period of a few years when people are likely to do something. After that, it's a slow and steady growth, or we have to do something that's really noticeable. So, for instance, when we if we implement bus rapid transit on Powell and or Division, then that would be enough that people would really notice it and people would change their behaviors regardless of what they've been set into. If it's, you know, one trip and extra in the morning, that might have an effect in a few years, but obviously not right away.
Well, and I guess the flip side of that is, you know, if a good example is we're looking right now at a project in Sellwood, and we can't, as a design commission, weigh in on whether it's really on a frequent service line or not, or whether, you know, parking is what it is, and mm-hmm. if there's parking to be designed, then we need to look at it. But we, you know, we don't have a say over whether it gets parking or not if,
right.
if the code says no. Right. So I guess, you know, one of the questions though, that has occurred to me is, you know, there's the promise of transit coming to this particular location in the form of the Milwaukee light rail line. The project will be built a full year before the light rail line is in. According to the neighborhood, and I think my own research bears this out, the frequent bus service is not actually anywhere near this project, although it's got some recognition from Metro as a transit-oriented project. So is it transit-oriented if the light rail isn't yet there and if there's no bus service or not really great bus service right there? And what are our expectations of those tenants becoming mostly transit riders?
Mm-hmm. I think I can say, you know, this is all based on professional judgment.
Sure.
I think I can say with a fair amount of confidence, though, that just 1 year mm-hmm. later is not enough for people to get so sort of ossified in their behavior that they're not going to notice a significant change.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea where this building is, so I don't know where it is in relation to a station. You'd have to take that into account.
So it's 700 or 800 feet, I think.
It's almost a quarter of a mile from the Tacoma station.
And it's not a nice quarter mile.
You got to walk across the Tacoma Bridge.
Quarter mile's not bad. It's not
it's
the best.
Bridge.
It's not
walk.
A lovely walk.
It's
yeah.
the
yeah.
bridge.
Yeah, and more importantly than the distance the bridge itself is the fact that they're probably having to cross those things that look a little like slip ramps.
Yeah.
But a quarter mile still is not bad. I mean, yeah. you know, you look at the light rail systems in Dallas or Salt Lake or whatever, they're walking farther over much less attractive mm-hmm. locations, and people are still doing it. That is enough to have an impact, but I couldn't tell you how much.
Mm-hmm.
And within 1 year is, I think, close enough. People are still relatively new. It's a significant new investment.
Mm-hmm.
If you have vehicles that you're gathering data on and you're finding that they're overloaded, I mean, you don't push a button and make everything better. What do you do?
Proof. No, that'd be great. We adjust our. We do a major service schedule update in early September, basically coinciding with the beginning of the school year, because that's when our ridership bumps up. That's when we're most likely to really adjust schedules to add service if we can. So the service that I'm talking about, the $2.1 million, starts September 5th or whatever it is this year. But three other times during the year, we also do schedule adjustments. So we're often able to, you know, if two buses in a row are overloaded, sometimes the very next one is almost empty. Or not almost empty, but has capacity. And so you can adjust the headways between them by a couple of minutes and get it a little more even. So we do those kinds of adjustments multiple times a year. We typically don't add a lot of service until September.
Okay.
I have a quick question.
Go ahead, Jane.
Oh, I was just going to ask how proactive is TriMet in the city planning process? Are you ever able to get ahead of the issue, or are you more in a reactive mode? And, you know, with the Portland plan and mm-hmm. 2035 plan and everything, Have you been involved, or has TriMet been involved?
We certainly have been, and beyond that, we've been talking about, well, I guess I should give some examples. So, you know, we'll sit on a TAC for one of the quadrant plans, or I just got a call from Carl Lyle this morning checking in on the West. We also are talking with the city, especially PBOT, about the potential for doing kind of a transit master plan for the city, and you know, have already started talking about doing that, and they came to us before they had even a sense of what the scope would be or anything. So I'm happy to say that we're able to work, I think, pretty closely with PBOT and BPS.
What kind of incentives are available to people who are developing apartments to encourage them to get their tenants on the bus? Are there any?
There's a lot of information out there, first of all, and we also have some past programs that I am not well qualified to tell you about, unfortunately. They're not a dramatic reduction in cost, but they are a reduction in cost, and the developers are able to, you know, come to work with us to come up with some kind of program. Mm-hmm.
So the past program doesn't have to be a business. It can be residential?
I believe there are cases of that. I don't think there are a lot. So I'd want to get you some more information before I told you exactly how it worked.
I'd like to see that information because it might be useful to pass on.
It might be useful to pass on. I mean, it is kind of a seller's market in terms of rents right now. I'm saying that there's not a high incentive for an apartment builder. Well, there's not an incentive for them to offer it, but it would be nice to see them do it, mm-hmm. you know, especially if, and if there were a way to tie that to parking reduction.
Yeah, and that would help the neighborhood if they understood that they were all passing out these passes.
Yeah.
Right. But again, service has to be there.
It's not our problem.
Yeah, which is what we're doing our best to be able to deliver.
Right. Okay. Are there other questions?
So it just seems generally that the easiest thing, I mean, for TriMet, when you guys are in these budget constraints, service is probably the easiest thing to save money on, right?
We could have cut a lot more service. I mean, instead, we laid off 200 people. We raised fares, which people were not happy about, but we asked the public and said, you know, we've got to save this extra money. Would you rather see it in fares or service? And overwhelmingly, they said, we'll take higher fares. That went along with a fare mitigation program for very low-income people so that, you know, we could mitigate that a bit. So we've done what we can. We spent probably too many years deferring maintenance as well. And so we're in a nice little flat spot here in terms of cost growth, where we're reinvesting in buses, doing those things so that we can survive another downturn without having to cut service again. Fingers crossed.
Oh, of course we will. One more question. Has TriMet it would have to be TriMet, have you ever commissioned a study to show sort of the difference in cost in maintaining a car for kind of the average income family of four versus trying to live on transit alone?
I know that information is out there. We've never had one specifically commissioned. I've certainly seen it even in discussion with Metro. Mm-hmm. So we could poke around and see if we can find something for you.
Wouldn't Alta have that?
They might. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know that they've actually looked at it. I mean, it's those are the kinds of numbers that, to me, for a transit agency, would be fairly compelling. I mean, mm-hmm. if you,
right.
one way for you to boost ridership, if that's your interest, to
talk about. Well, the kinds of, you know, the round numbers are, you know, owning a car, the costs and everything is somewhere between $8,000 and $10,000 a year mm-hmm. if you add everything. Mm-hmm. You know, the cost of a bus pass is more like $1,000 if it's an all, mm-hmm. if it's, you know.
And then you factor in the difference between the amount of time you have to wait for a bus and how much longer it might take you to get there. You know, you have to factor that in. But, mm-hmm. You know, there
versus parking costs and everything else.
Absolutely,
yeah.
All the other things, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it would be, I think, compelling for you. To
every comparison I've seen has been positive.
Sure. Right. Sure.
So, that's the side of the buses. Yeah.
I think that's the kind of, you know, when you got some free advertising space.
Right.
Great.
Great.
Work on that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
You could save $10 this morning.
Exactly.
Whatever.
Yeah.
with an arrow pointing at one of the passengers.
Yeah, yeah, right. We got it solved.
All right. Any other questions or comments before we send Ellen on his way? Okay. Thank you for coming here today.
Thanks.
We appreciate
it. Happy to be here. Thanks for your time.
Appreciate it. Thanks to our applicant for waiting.